welcome to Disembodied Podcast. This is Evie Escher. This week I've got Alex Utterman with me, and she spent many years living in South India, learning ancient healing techniques from the enlightened masters there. This includes radical self-care techniques that bring instant relief to modern everyday people who suffer stress, who feel overwhelmed, who feel burnout, anxiety, and PTSD. Her decades of work as a global spiritual inspirational healing leader have helped train master healers all over the world. As the co-founder of UCBK, which is the Universal Church of Baba's Kitchen, Alex's mission has been to spread healing and happiness far and wide, and to empower everyone to heal themselves through radical self-care. You can find her healing classes, ceremonies, sessions, and webinars at ucbk.org, and her radical self-care techniques at energeticsofselfcare.com. So Alex's name may confuse you a little bit. It's A-L-X. She kind of threw out the E there. So I have a lot of E's in my name, and I love my E's. You know, E's are the fifth letter of the alphabet, so five tends to represent freedom. Alex threw out one of her E's, so this is coming out on the solstice, so happy solstice. And Merry Christmas upcoming. Anyway, you'll enjoy this interview. Here we go. Alex, welcome to Disembodied Podcast. It's great to have you.
Oh, so happy to be here. Thank you.
I really like your background because you actually spent time in India. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that and how you got started in energetic healing and all of the things that you do.
Right. Well, it's a strange and interesting story. The truncated version, because I could talk for 10 hours about how this all came around, is that I came to it very skeptically. I was not a woo-woo person. I was not religious at all. And certainly, I would say healthfully agnostic, probably at best. So even spirituality in the New Age form and the whole California trip was like, oh my God, no, keep that stuff away from me. So I came to it pretty reluctantly. And I have to say, I was living in the Santa Cruz Mountains and working a lot in Silicon Valley. And I was surrounded by people who were real spiritual seekers. You know, they were like, hey, so such great, you know, Tibetan Lama or speaker is coming to the New Age bookstore. Do you want to go hear them? I'm like, yeah, no, got to wash my hair. I was really bad. I was just like, hell no, keep it away. So I have to say the real spiritual traditions and energy systems that came to me, literally came to me. I didn't go looking. They sort of broadsided me actually. And India was the last of those. There were a few things that hit me in between that were real, including Reiki. Of course, I was initiated Reiki and then started doing Reiki healings and started seeing miraculous and inexplicable things happening during the course of doing Reiki for people. At the same time, it was kind of like throwing pasta at the wall, you know, like you throw the energy and you hope it sticks and you don't really know what it is or how it operates. And the Reiki people that I spoke to, they would get all kind of fuzzy and mystical and smug and say, oh, well, the energy just takes care of it, you know? And I'm like, okay, but that's not clear. So I became a Reiki master hoping that that would solve the issue of how does this stuff work? And in fact, it just opened up more questions. For example, if I did Reiki on someone's broken ankle to help with the pain they were experiencing, the ankle still hurt at the end of an hour session, but their asthma cleared up for good. Riddle me this. It made no sense. So that's kind of where I was in the fall of 1999, when a character named Jonathan Rosen, who was a longtime TM meditator and a real yogi, a real Western New York born bombastic actor and management consultant, came into my life. And he was a student of this miracle healing saint named Kaleshwar, who at the time was all of 27 years old, I think. And he's telling me about Kaleshwar, this young lion of South India. And as he's telling me about this miracle healing saint, I mean, I knew about gurus. I had read Autobiography of a Yogi. I had a terrific respect for the tradition, just didn't feel like that's not for me. And as this middle-aged Jewish guy is telling me about this extraordinary healing master who healed a friend of Jonathan's from a terminal cancer in, I don't know, 5 minutes. terminal. I mean, metastasized stage four, was going for an experimental treatment program to be a statistic for research for cancer. The guy was 52 years old. He was scared out of his mind. He didn't want to die. He heard some miracle healing saint was coming from India to LA, called his friend Jonathan, said, "I'm terrified. I have nothing to lose. Will you go with me?" And Jonathan said, of course, yeah. And so the two of them converged in LA, where the then 24-year-old Kaleshwar, who was skinny as a rail, looking kind of sick, super intense, unbelievable energy, like a total tiger, and had like maybe six words of English. So he was kind of this fierce, incomprehensible being who looked like kind of like a teenager. People were like, okay, where's the master? Because there's this Indian kid here. Yeah. And he looked at Doug, the guy with the terminal cancer, had him open his mouth, stick out his tongue, literally gestured like that, and then manifested from his fingertips, from the index finger and the thumb, ash onto Doug's tongue. Jonathan was watching, going, "Oh my God." And then put a little bit of ash manifested from his thumb onto Doug's third eye. And then just kind of went, meh, okay, next. And Jonathan said the energy that accompanied that was so discombobulating, it stirred up his own inner, let's say, purification starting. His own soul was very moved by this. Not wowed by a miracle, but kind of like the energetic wave that accompanied it hit him hard. Okay, so Doug went after, I think, about a week to be tested for the experimental treatment program. It was like Johns Hopkins or Harvard Medical or whatever. And they said, "Wow," they're doing his intake. And they said, "Well, your chemo must have worked great because you're cancer free." And Doug said, "What are you talking about? I have a lymphoma that's in my entire system." They said, "Wow. No, you don't." He said, "I didn't do chemotherapy." They said, "Well, whatever you did, it worked. You're cancer free." Jonathan said, "What? How did he do that? In 30 years of focused meditation, dedicated meditation." Jonathan was a really powerful guy. He had never seen the accrued meditation energy translate into a physical transformation like that so rapidly. So he got hooked and had become a Kaleshwar student. And then I met him about 2 years later. As he was telling me these stories, I'm seeing his face turn into this young brown guy. And I'm like, okay, that's going to be the guru. That's a little disturbing. But okay. All right. And then for a couple of weeks after that, people I would speak to, so funny, I would say, "I'm hearing about this young miracle healing saint from India. I'm a little interested in that." Because there was something about making spiritual energy practical that made sense to me and that spoke to me very deeply. I wasn't interested in just meditating for the betterment of the world or spirituality for the sake of some new age make it up as you go feeling. I wanted the reality. I wanted to know how things work. And here was somebody who was saying, "Yeah, well, so Kaleshwar would say, yeah, I have supernatural abilities. It's true. So does every human being. And if you're willing to do hard work, I will teach everything that I know." And many of us were like, okay, going to India. So I was like, all right, finally, somebody who knows how to fix the damn car, not just drive it. If it breaks down, you kind of want to know what's under the hood, or at least I did. So this really spoke to me. And within a few weeks, actually, so then I would tell people, "Yeah, I'm hearing about this, healing guru from India, this miracle young saint." And their face would turn into the young brown guy. And they would say to me something like, "Well, what do you really want, Alex?" And I was like, okay, so at this point, I feel like I'm being stalked by God. And this is really disturbing. I'm not liking this. I think it's a little weird. And so then Jonathan said to me, "Hey, he's coming to Seattle in a couple of weeks. Do you want to meet him?" Yeah, of course. Done. Signed, sealed, delivered. Yes. So I met him actually in the SeaTac airport baggage claim. Perfect place to meet a guru. And he was luminous and ebullient and almost didn't look like a real human being. He was so light. It is almost like seeing a hologram in front of your eyes. Like, is that real? Is that real? And funnier than all get out. I mean, he was hilarious and brilliant. He had learned some pretty choice English by the time I met him, which was a relief. And I had the experience of hanging around Kaleshwar with his students. We stayed in a house with him, which was quite interesting. with other spiritual communities, with top management people from Boeing and Microsoft. So I got to see him in all these different environments. And a couple things struck me. The first was that he was completely relaxed. I mean, he was a 27-year-old kid, by some estimation, completely in charge, with the full kind of divine authority of someone who doesn't need to exert himself in the least, and was demonstrating miracles. It was so crazy.
How did Boeing get involved?
One would wonder, right? Well, it turned out Jonathan and the guy who owned the house in Seattle where we stayed, there were like, I don't know, 12 or 14 of us, I think, for about a week with Kalishwar, I think. They were both top management consultants for Fortune 100 and 500 companies. And they had actually taken executives, you know, really like high management levels from big companies to India to hang out with Kalishwar. I think it was the summer of 1999, because they wanted those organizational leaders who were interested in real transformation or serving humanity, not just, you know, the bottom line, to have the blessing of this divine saint. So when he came to Seattle, Seattle has both Boeing headquartered there and also Microsoft. A lot of their contacts in that world were very interested to come and meet Kalishwar directly.
Like the intersection of the corporate world with miracle healing.
Yes, it was extraordinary. And I remember him saying right before they all came, he said, "Why are you guys doing this to me? You know, like, I think these people don't really believe in God, right? So how am I supposed to deal with them?" And it was funny because for them, for that particular audience, I have to say, Kalishwar kind of morphed into a sort of almost more like a Tony Robbins kind of character, more kind of personal growthy. And whatever he was saying on the surface, it was hilarious because one level, it's like he was engaging their minds, talking, I don't even know what, about spirituality or this and that. But the amount of energy that he was transmitting at the same time was like a wave of almost like trance-inducing power. So it was this weird combination of these people like trying to listen to him politely, and then they're kind of like going in a kind of rope-a-dope trance at the same time, because he was doing this massive healing for all of their hearts. Without their conscious awareness.
Removing the corporate greed.
No kidding, right? And kind of, I think the angle was to elevate their souls enough that perhaps they could make their companies more of a blessing to the world, less hard greed, bottom line driven, you know, like that. There's always that dynamic tension in the upper levels of these companies. They want to be forward thinking. They want to do well by their employees and generally by society. And at the same time, they have massive military contracts. And, you know,
I know it's a conflict of interest, seemingly. You know, I mean, apparently, it's like, First of all, companies are publicly traded, typically big ones. And, you know, they have to have some sort of bottom line for their stock and all that.
They have to answer to the shareholders.
Yeah. And I understand it all, but it's interesting how maybe this is a step toward progress globally, if corporations could become a little more ethical here and there.
Well, I think it's very interesting. You know, if you look at Steve Jobs, he was a lifelong spiritual character. I mean, he used to meditate in the same Zen center that I meditated in the Santa Cruz Mountains. In fact, he was on the board of it.
I thought he was an angry person. I thought, wasn't he?
Yes. And there's that other side. The only book that he kept on his iPhone was Yogananda's Autobiography of a Yogi.
Okay. I didn't know that.
And at his funeral, they handed that out to everybody, a physical hard copy of Autobiography of a Yogi. He had a total spiritual side. Jack Dorsey of Twitter, CEO who just stepped down. Spiritual seeker guy, trying everything. It's a really weird intersection. I think people in a position of real power, I think they hit the wall realizing, okay, but isn't there more to life? Like, okay, I've achieved all this. I have all this money. I have all this influence. I have all this prestige. I have what passes for power in our world. Okay, but now what? Because I still don't feel fulfilled inside. And I think that's the kind of turning point that could be of great benefit, I think, to corporate America and to the structures. You know, what I saw, because we did management consulting inside HP and Boeing and all these really high level companies, was that there was a humane you know, organizations are composed of people.
Yes.
Regardless of what their corporate front is, or their sort of image in the world, or how they promote themselves, or the kinds of contracts that they take, which are pretty heinous. But they're good-hearted people who feel that they're working towards something that's of value to the world. And I think tapping more into that side of it is requisite, actually. And that's what Jonathan and his friend were kind of bringing into the world of management consulting. In fact, Jonathan got techniques from Kaleshwar to transform the corporate environment using miracle healing and meditation techniques that he was doing in corporate. People didn't know it on his contracts. They couldn't figure out how he was getting these results. These like radical shifts in the whole organization, and tracked, you know, with metrics, because he had a business partner who handled all the more traditional consulting, you know, tools. They couldn't figure it out. It was literally miraculous.
It almost sounds slightly unethical if he's doing things unbeknownst to the people.
Well, for instance,
the energy. I don't know.
For instance, however, it got the results, right? So do they really care what the methodology is? So for example, there were two companies, big ones, who were having a 30-year conflict and they had to work together. Okay. One was a big juice company and the other was a big railroad. The juice company was forward-thinking, both feet in the, you know, 21st century, and the railroad was stuck back in like the 19th century. And they were adversarial. They were to the point where their counterparts on both sides of these companies would have screaming matches on the phone and hang up on each other for 30 years. They had all the big consulting firms come in, Anderson, this one, that one. Everybody identified the problem. You guys are at loggerheads for 30 years and this needs to change. And tried to do, you know, traditional consulting methods, whatever. It didn't work. Jonathan and his partner got the gig. I think probably it was like a last ditch. So what Jonathan did on the surface was bring improvisational theater into the corporate environment to get all the stories from all the upper management levels all the way down to like the rail yard workers. And then his team of actors would play it back, mirroring the salient points and the conflicts and the difficulties with some humor, but also true to it, a real mirror of what is going on here so that everybody could see it. And so they would flush out the truth and get everybody emotionally connected and admitting a lot of the things that, you know,
they wanted one side to see the other side as more human, I'm sure.
Correct. You know. And everybody to acknowledge the depths of the kind of, you know, the suffering that everyone was going through because of this conflict. So at the end of their conventional stuff, the management, you know, metrics in place to measure what would be good results over time, putting that in place and doing the improv theater to flush out the truth and play it back, then Jonathan would say, okay, let's do a guided visualization based on what you guys have all said here, which is that these exact specific conditions are really screwed up. You need them to change. You've had every management consultant for 30 years tell you need to change this. Let's do a 20-minute guided visualization, right? These are like good old boys in suspenders with cigars from the railroad side, right? And the suit and tie from the juice company.
Yeah.
Sitting in a room together. And he said, you know, like professional athletes will visualize the perfect, let's say, shooting hoops or the perfect golf swing. They'll play it over in their mind and then they'll actually have better performance. That's been tested and proven, right? So he would say, we're going to visualize what is the optimum working environment for you in this 20-minute visualization, right? He put on some nice music. He'd tell them to close their eyes and just imagine how they would like it to be. Meanwhile, on the subtle, he's blasting them with mantras and his accrued meditation energy to enact an enormous healing for all of these people. They came out of it 20 minutes later. They said, oh, well, that was relaxing. Would you believe the next day the behavior started to change? Boom.
It is kind of consensual because they're agreeing to go through the guided meditation.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And they want the healing. Mm-hmm. They just don't. I mean, if you explained to them, hey, this came from this kooky Indian saint who does miracles in India. Yeah, forget it. Forget it. No, don't even. No need to say what the methodology involved is. And the results were there. So like that. So corporate miracles were being enacted by these couple guys who were students of Kaleshwar. It was extraordinary to watch that.
I'm all for it, really, because I know that, you know, we all have to make a living somehow. And when you are in a corporation and you don't get along with people, it's excruciating, whether it's a client or coworkers or whatever, it can be excruciating. So I think it's a tremendous relief to your life just to get along with whomever you're working with.
Absolutely. Well, and if you look at also in corporate culture, you know, a lot of it is based on like superstars who are overachievers who are working 60 plus hours. Yeah, that's not tenable. We know that, right? The human system will go through stress and trauma and it will break down with that kind of pressure. So in a lot of these corporations, there's this constant search and kind of inner dynamic of trying to find the work-life balance. Mm-hmm. Where again, these kinds of techniques came in extraordinarily handy to start to really open that up and start to help people. I think it's a little by any means necessary. And sometimes you really don't want to know what's in the sausage. You just want to eat it and enjoy it. And
yeah, that's a good way to see it, actually. A lot of stuff seems far out and weird, okay, to the average everyday person. But, you know, there's a lot of weird stuff that happens even in the course of a normal life. So if you can kind of, you know, like digest that part, then maybe something out there wouldn't be so out there.
Right. Exactly. Yes.
So I do kind of want to go back to your own development because we talked a lot about the corporate world and that is interesting. But what about how did you develop when you went to India? I mean, tell me what you went through.
Well, so I can tell you the first thing that happened when I met Kaleshwar, he did a healing for me, a miracle healing. He would say, you know, 90% of people in this planet are suffering the primary disease. The top number one disease is heartbreak. And not only romantic, right? In the West, we tend to think, oh, it's a breakup. Yeah, no, extreme loss, trauma in family of origin, or maybe somebody grew up in a war zone. It could be betrayal in business or by a good friend. It could be professional disappointment. It can be heartbreak with God. There's a lot of heartbreak with religions, you know, and rightly so. This kind of devastating primordial split that happens in us, usually pretty young. And then each subsequent heartbreak just kind of doubles and triples and quadruples down on that initial, whatever it was. And his contention was all of the physical suffering, all of the emotional suffering is coming from heartbreak. So there are plenty of hospitals, you know, to fix broken minds. There are plenty of hospitals to fix broken bodies. There aren't that many hospitals to address the broken heart. And what Kaleshwar was offering was, I want to make you guys soul doctors, heart doctors, to be able to understand the full spectrum of human suffering, which is not just one thing, right? This, everybody has their particular story, their particular configuration of pain and trauma and suffering. So how to address that? Well, you need a wide spectrum of understanding, a wide spectrum of tools. And so he was giving information straight from ancient manuscripts of India, like 5,000, 7,000 year old manuscripts that had been written by great, great seers, great sages, who kind of saw the whole blueprint of creation, including how to fix what ails people from every angle you can imagine. So they wrote it down in these beautiful, on dried palms leaves, like stacked palm leaf books. Amazing human treasure, actually, for humanity. And Kaleshwar would decipher them, which sometimes took a lot of work because they wrote in code and they mixed up languages and stuff. It's really crazy. And he would say, okay, let me see what remedy are they giving that would be useful for people today? And he would test it out. If it worked, he would teach it to us. So he would often say, hey, guys, I'm not making this up. This is not my own craziness, right? This is from the ancient saints. I tested it out. It works. I'm giving it to you. So generally it was in the form of mantras, you know, like formulas, syllables, divine syllables that could shift something in a human structure very quickly. Also yantras, diagrams, you know, like what people call mandalas or whatever.
Yeah, those are beautiful.
Yeah. And sometimes the two working in concert. So there were a lot, I mean, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of techniques. It was kind of like going to medical school for how to approach the human soul and all of its myriad sufferings and nuances of that and how to repair it.
Isn't part of the problem with humans fixing them is that not only do they suffer the event that breaks their heart, but also reflecting back on it repeatedly throughout their lives, right? Isn't that the problem in a way?
It is. I think it can be a problem. One level, I think you have to do that to kind of do your own inner research about how and why did that happen? I think the cry of every soul is, why did this happen to me? You know, what is this crazy planet? How could this be? Right? The outrage, you know, Shakespeare called it the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. And my contention is it's outrageous because it happened to me. How could this be? Right?
I've met people who said things like, oh, I stopped believing in God because once I watched my mom die of cancer, I just knew there was no God anymore.
How could that happen?
Yeah. So, and some people have they have terrible misfortunes even as children and teenagers. Yes. I mean, I'm kind of shocked because, you know, I've had some misfortune too, but I mean, it came later, not so much earlier.
Mm. Interesting. So I think on one part, we have to do that research to figure out as a soul in this body, in this creation, in this planet, what is this? Right. So, I mean, for myself, I like to joke, I was raised in the house of death. I was the last of six kids. My parents were older when I was born. My father had his first heart attack when I was 5, and my mother was diagnosed with terminal cancer when I was 3 years old. So she died by the time I was 9, and it was a slow decline. It was leukemia. And my dad had a second heart attack when I was 14, had a bypass surgery, you know, open heart in those days, and lived until I was about 25. So by the time I'm 25, both of my parents are gone, done. And there was a lot of torture in between, a lot of trauma. And my dad remarried a horrible woman who was an alcoholic and physically abusive. And I was the object of her hatred. So I really went through like trauma central. And I remember looking at the other kids, my peers, who didn't seem to have any of this stuff going on. And I'm thinking, what? Right? I mean, I'm like 8 years old going, how is this possible? What is this crazy planet? I felt like I had stepped into a madhouse. And I would say what a gift that was, because it made me start examining at a very young age, asking the really significant questions. Who am I really? Right? I was pretty sure I was more than just this little form that was going through all this crazy stuff, but I couldn't reconcile it. I couldn't make sense of it. Where did I come from? Right? Was I somewhere before I was born in this body? Probably. Where? Because this place seemed like a hellhole. So I'm like, well, but there has to be some other. Another question is, what is my purpose in this life? Why did I come here? What am I doing here? And how come I'm going through all of these insane waves of trauma and extreme heartbreak at a very young age? Why? Right? If we don't look at that, then we can't make any sense of anything. So the idea of the therapeutic model, where you keep talking about the trauma over and over and over again, it feels like it's just cementing that again and again and again. And that can become a rut from which it's hard to get out of it. However, there's this other side of, okay, well, wait, if there's such a thing as karma, if there's such a thing, which is dependent then on reincarnation, right? I got slammed at a young age by things that were completely, I mean, really insane. I mean, I would tell therapists about my life when I was in my mid-20s and they would start to weep. They're like, how did you make it through all that? Well, it woke me up. You know, I wouldn't change an inch of it now, but it was quite a journey, you know, into the extremes of heartbreak and trauma and abuse and all of that. So it was a gift to have to research on that and to say, so if karma is true, let's just say for a minute, maybe that's possible. Then that would imply that I had multiple lifetimes where I probably behaved like a total schmuck. And I don't remember any of that. But action to reaction, we know from Newton's law of thermodynamics, right? For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. So gauging by the reactions I was getting that make absolutely no sense on the surface level, some action had to have been there, or maybe a cumulative, you know, mountain of actions to elicit this kind of reaction in this lifetime at a tender age. Okay, that seems, it's a bitter pill to swallow, but it seems on some bizarre level reasonable. So in that sense, then going back and looking at it and thinking, wow. I mean, I remember being like 12, 13 years old with my stepmother just raging and, you know, horrible, and thinking, God, I must have done something really terrible to her somewhere, because this honestly makes no sense. This is insane.
I mean, I don't know if it's entirely karmic or if it's just you have to learn how to deal with others who are not going to treat you right. I don't know if it's all karmic. We're in this world, we're in this incarnation, and we have to make our way. And there will be lots of people who will step up to abuse you. Yes, because it's not convenient to love you, or it's not convenient to take care of you or whatever, or interact with you in a pleasant way because they're having a bad day, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So you have to assert yourself at some point. And I don't think everything's karma. I think sometimes it's just standing up and saying, you know what? Not going to deal with that anymore. Not going to deal with you anymore. And these are huge leaps for your own well-being, don't you think?
Oh, I do. I left home at 15 because I had it with somebody who was trying to murder me every day. I was just like, I'm done.
That's pretty young. I mean,
married her. I didn't see you later. Yeah. And I went to college at 16. So I was done. I was done. However, I will say the reverberations of all of that, the PTSD from that. Oh my God. By the time I hit my mid 20s, I was a basket case of all of this unresolved, unanswered, unprocessed, what do you do with that, you know, kind of pain.
Yeah.
So I had to go through a really strong healing process myself, even before I came to quote unquote spirituality, in order to try to reckon with it the best that I could. My point is, I think that walking away from a toxic person doesn't change the inner reverberations of having been on the receiving end of something like that. That we have to reckon with.
You're right. You have to undo all of that negativity somehow.
And that's the real spiritual healing, I would say. That, you know, I mean, obviously my own story was colossal heartbreak. I'm not alone in that. Of course, there's nothing unique about me. In fact, I meet plenty of people in my healing practice who had it way worse than I did. But I would offer it as a karma. It's a karma to intersect with any person, even some random person on the freeway, you know, who's angry and flips you off. It's a karma to intersect with a beautiful person who gives you a blessing. You know, karma is not only bad, right? It's action to reaction only, purely. It's not emotional. Although we experience it that way because we're like, well, oh my God, you know, how could this happen to me? But I think it's more along the lines of it's happening for me. Mm-hmm. Or in other words, it's happening to wake us up. It's happening to educate not our minds so much, but the soul, the inner works that came here to experience what it's like to be alive in a human form and to evolve, or to say, to elevate its awareness. So when we start becoming more aware as spiritual creatures, we become aware of this dynamic of, oh my gosh, you know, if I was cross with someone in the morning, it's very likely by the evening, someone is going to unload on me. And if I'm smart, I'll be like, wait, why are they? Oh, well, actually, I kind of lost it there this morning. Interesting. Sometimes it's that immediate and it's that instant. It's like a reflection in the mirror of nature. And I think that's part of how nature itself is teaching us to handle or to wake up to our role in this planet, in this three-dimensional world of this divine kind of nature that's playing out a very, very big cinema show for all of us to be a participant in and to learn through it. It's not an easy learning. I would say it's very rigorous, actually.
Well, and I think you may get to a point where you think, okay, I'm doing pretty well. And then you have something else comes up and it's like you're having
to keep on going.
Yeah. You're having to relearn and maybe jump through even larger hoops or smaller hoops or however you want to look at it. It's, you're still going to have challenges, even if you're 75 and you've mastered this and mastered that, you're still going to have challenges, I think.
Yes, all the enlightened souls, it doesn't mean they get a free pass, man. In fact, usually the challenges get harder and heavier and the waves are taller. And it's kind of like, it's akin to, you know, when you're a bright kid in class and the teacher realizes that and they pile more work on you.
Yeah, that's it.
It's like Mother Teresa used to say, you know, like Jesus really gives a lot of hard challenges to the people he trusts. And she would say, I sometimes wish he didn't trust me quite so much. You know, that's the flavor of it though. And so, you know, there's never a lack of challenges. There's never a lack of problems. What's different is how do we receive them? How do we understand them? And how much inner strength have we built at the level of the soul, not the level of the mind, in order to have a kind of like divine energy running in us all the time that creates its own kind of little engine of resiliency. So the hits come and you go, huh, well, that was a hit. 10 years ago, that would have taken me out. I would have been crying for days. And now I'm like, okay, ouch. Why did that happen? How do I look at that? What kind of a reflection is it? Is it that I did something funky and now I'm getting some kind of reflection back? Is it the light that I represent is starting to stir up the shadows in someone else and they're projecting it on me? Did I make a big mistake here? Do I need to take acknowledgement for that? Like a whole, you know, in a nanosecond, about a million things pass through my awareness about how to analyze this thing that just happened. And once I see what's at the root of it, then I'm like, huh, okay, take the appropriate action and then keep moving so that the things don't take me down the way that they once did, even though the things are of that magnitude. It's fine. So I think when the inner works change, when the inner works grow really strong, and I would say that's what I got from India, where the techniques to build the soul so strong that the resilience is, I mean, sometimes I'm flat out astonished. I'm like, wow, okay, so you didn't have a giant crazy reaction to that thing that just happened that was really aimed to be painful. All right, good for you. Well done. Pat on the back, you know?
What did you learn in India that you think helped you the most? I think this is going to be a hard question, but I mean, is there like one sort of idea or technique that really kind of like made you steam forward?
Wow. Well, so I have to say, it's a really interesting question. It wasn't just one thing. It was a compendium of things and it's cumulative over time, I would say. Mm-hmm. Anyone who tells you you'll get enlightened in a few hours is yanking your chain.
Definitely.
I spent 5 years in an immersive environment, having the guidance of a top healing saint on the planet directly. And it was a crucible. It requires a lot of burning. It requires a lot of willingness to have your egoism utterly taken apart. Not in any obvious overt way, but like 1,000 paper cuts a day, often from colleagues, often from friends on the ashram in the mirror of this lens of nature, and being willing to come completely down as a humble character and recognize, oh, so much of this overlay of the personality, so much of this problem of the mind. Especially, I think in the West, you know, we tend to value the mind or disproportionately. We love our intellect. We love intellectual achievement. We have, you know, universities that celebrate loads of facts being memorized and histories. And oh my God, we put all this up on a big altar. And yet some of the very smartest people are not necessarily emotionally very accessible or functional because the heartbreak is there. It's just, they've developed one aspect of what we call the mind. In the Eastern traditions, they will refer to the mind as a monkey because it's just this mischievous thing that's jumping around branch to branch, distracted, always looking for entertainment, and often throws us off the very thing that's real and that's important for us. So I think a lot of it had to do with the mind coming down, down, down. So we did hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of meditation techniques. Sometimes I was meditating, you know, for like 4 or 5 months at a time, I would say about 16, 18 hours a day, nonstop. Yes, it was quite rigorous in order to build the amount of energy it would take to be able to handle a particular angle of bringing healing to humanity. And in the process of doing all that meditation, all of my own stuff, all my own shadows, all my own crazy mind, crazy projections, you know, negative emotions, right? Jealousy, anger, pride, arrogance, egoism, selfishness, fear, feeling left out, feeling depressed, all this stuff was coming up, 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 not to be a torture necessarily, but to come up and out, but to fry it out. So the whole process of it, punctuated by unbelievable, miraculous demonstrations by Kaleshwar, by all of us students, within a few years, we were also demonstrating extraordinary, miraculous things, bringing dead birds back to life, making holy objects emit different types of fluids, holy fluids. Yeah, just astounding. Mind shattering, miraculous experiences. All of that was in the mix. And I would say probably the biggest thing was learning how to not listen to the mind at the end of that, and referring again and again to the inner consciousness and watching it start to grow and get stronger through doing all these intense meditation practices. You know, I mean, a simple example is like when you have an intuition that tells you, hey, you should do this thing. And if you've lived long enough, you know, oh God, there's that inner voice. I better go do that thing, because how many times I haven't listened to that and then regretted it. Like, oh, I should have listened when that came. That inner voice, that inner consciousness is the real voice, I would say. That little tug in our inner makeup that seems to override the mind. It's clearly not the mind. Developing that until that thing is in the ascendant rather than what passes for the surface mind.
Yeah, the mind can rationalize everything, right? It can even rationalize violence. It can rationalize doing terrible things to people. So
yeah, it's all alternative facts. The mind will say, well, this is truth because I think it is. Regardless of what's true or not, it doesn't matter.
We're very familiar with that in the US.
Yes, we are. And we've seen it play out, you know, on a national stage, but it's a human tendency, right? It's just writ large right now. Mm-hmm. That has to come down. And I think when we're operating more from what I'm calling the soul, but I would kind of interchangeably use the term the heart. When the heart is repaired, when the heart is healed from its 1,000 natural shocks, right? Then we're operating from that place. Then we can reach the world and interact with it from the heart first rather than the mind. So when we're doing that, everything falls into place. It's very easy. Selflessness comes automatically. Kindness comes automatically. Concern for other people, compassion for other people, a sense of authenticity is simply there. There's nothing to hide because there's no structure of fear overlaying the thing. And there's no broken place inside that needs sheltering, hiding. Oh, that's my shadow. Nobody should see that place, blah, blah, blah. So there's nothing to protect. So then we can be transparent, real, authentic, easy in the world. And I would say that's one of the results, I think, of having gone through such a rigorous training and being able to then turn around and teach and heal, you know, with that kind of energetic authority, let's say, the lived experience of, hey, you know, I have to say, having gone through all that, looking back at my life, childhood, traumas, all the stuff, I can see the great reason, you know, for having been put through all that. Hey, how could I possibly help anyone if I haven't lived it myself? Who would listen to anybody who comes in perfect, has a perfect life? There's never been a hardship. There's no trauma. Really? You're going to heal me? You can't even relate to me. I can't relate to you. Right? Yeah. But having been.
It's important because I think that it, just for like a simple example of how can you ever really relate to poor people if you've never had a hard time paying your rent or never had car trouble and not been able to afford to repair the car or whatever.
Or had to go a day or two without food.
Exactly. And it gets worse and worse. I mean, it could be living on the street or whatever. I mean, I've actually known people who have lived on the street for a while. I've met a few.
Me too.
And these are the only ways that you're ever going to understand what other people go through, because everybody else just looks like a pathetic loser to you when you've always had these things in your reach and you've never been without them.
That's right. So in a way, I think the divine awakening means heartbreak, actually. It means the legs of the chair that you're so used to having so securely underneath you have to get taken out at a certain point for people to wake up.
I mean, that's trial by fire, right?
It is. And it's also until you experience extreme loss of some kind, extreme heartbreak of some kind, you don't even have the lips to speak about human suffering or pain. You know, and how could you be empathetic, as you're saying, if you haven't tasted something like that, right? So when the wheels come off the wagon, you know, when people who maybe had extreme privilege suddenly go through really hard times or real loss of some kind, it has a way of cracking the heart open. Sometimes, other times it hardens the heart because it's so painful they can't even look at it. And then you'll see somebody who's extremely cynical, who will say, like the example you gave earlier, you know, my mother died of cancer. Forget it. I don't believe in God anymore. Having seen that, I'm done. Right? That's a big heartbreak with the divine. And it's enough to close people sometimes for life, right? You see them older and they're bitter and cynical and, you know, who cares about all that? Who cares about other people? I got mine, right? I'm okay. Or they will insulate themselves with excess weight or an extreme fortune, some way to make themselves feel safe in a world that otherwise doesn't feel very safe to them because it is precarious, you know, yeah. And loss is potentially around the corner. And maybe, you know, that feeling of being under assault in some way, it doesn't leave you just because you have a lot of wealth or because you have enough food or like that, right?
So you are kind of a self-care guru.
And oh God, yes.
For this holiday season upon us, I don't currently feel any stress. I do not have children. I do not have to give lavish gifts to anybody. I haven't done anything like that ever, really. So for the people out there who are feeling pressure to be with relatives that they may have problems with, or, you know, you know, spend a lot of money on gifts and they feel that like pressure of trying to fit in and trying to curry favor with others, let's say, whether it's family or friends, what would you suggest for people to do in this holiday season to kind of like get away from that somehow, even though you have to participate in it?
Yeah, well, oh boy. I'd offer in the mix, not only people who are feeling it stressful to come, you know, with their family. There are plenty of people right now hospitalized across the US because COVID is on the rise again. So there's that kind of pain and trauma and anxiety. Are they going to lose a loved one? Is somebody going to end up with long COVID? There's also, you know, economically, people have been really slammed. There are a lot of people who are having a very, very difficult time making ends meet, or they can't make ends meet. So there's that kind of stress feeling of how can I even approach a holiday when all these different things are going on potentially that are very painful? Or we have frontline workers who are, you know, they get up, they work, they see suffering and death in record numbers, and they have to get up the next day and go back in and do it again. Some of them are punching out and then they're starting a second shift immediately. How can you even begin to relate to a holiday in the midst of this kind of uncertainty and difficulty and, you know, like that? Plus, of course, politically, we're all very charged. There's a lot of polarization. So there are a lot of arguments around the family tables, or people not seeing their family this year, or certain members of the family for all kinds of reasons of the divide of everything. You know, so there's a lot of stress in the environment and the atmosphere, I would say, going into this holiday season, which is supposed to be, you know, celebratory and peaceful and a time when we all come together and sort of unite in our deeper humanity, right? Yeah, there are tons of techniques. One of the things that I learned from Kaleshwar very early on, so his deal was preparing master healers, right? And he would say this: if you're going to handle the suffering of humanity, you need to know how to process it efficiently so that it doesn't take you down. A lot of healers in many traditions end up getting very sick because they don't have a good apparatus through which to dissolve the energetics that they absorb from other people naturally. Okay, that's healers on one level. That's also medical professionals. That's also EMS. That's also anybody who works with other people. Maybe they're in customer service and they're getting earfuls every day. Or maybe they're a psychotherapist. Or maybe they're in retail or food service. And they're getting a lot of input from maybe very stressed people all the time. We naturally absorb the stress of others. That's, if you have an open heart, it's like a big sponge. And automatically, without our notice, we absorb a lot of the pain and suffering of other people. It's natural. It's a beautiful thing to do. However, you know very well, if a sponge gets too full, it can't absorb anything and you've got to wring it out, right? There are literally techniques that we learned from the get-go, from ancient India, but they apply now to dissolve, or literally to decharge the negativity that we automatically absorb from other people, from the environment, from social media, from whatever it is that we have. Here's the crazy thing. The human system is like a battery. It can hold positive charges. It can hold negative charges. If you think about it, we're like bags of water with semi-precious minerals in there, metals, right? We have copper and zinc and these things. We're kind of like a battery, actually, mechanistically. Positive charges are like beautiful experiences, right? Things that make us feel really heartful. Maybe it's a beautiful sunset that brings us to tears, or a piece of art, you know, or a performance, or a film, or an interaction with a loved one, or being of service to people, you know, like volunteering. That's a really good charge for us inside. Or a great meditation, you know, or some sort of spiritual experience. Great. Those we want to keep in our system. We want to hold on to those and develop those so we get actually stronger inside. Negative charges. Somebody yells at us, a dirty look, somebody reams you out on social media, an argument, a stressful encounter with a client or coworker or whatever, family member. These things, they also will stay in our system and they'll keep reverberating until we have a way to pull them out energetically, to literally decharge that negative charge from our system, from the subtle energy. A lot of people I meet, they're like, no, I'm fine. You know, I go to work. Yeah, it's hard. I'm like, mm-hmm. And how do you feel when you come home? School teachers, clergy, retail workers. Oh, I feel like I've been hit by a truck. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you think that's normal, right? Or maybe they have a headache, or maybe something hurts somewhere in the system. Or maybe they had a client and they cannot stop thinking about that person's situation for the rest of the night. These are charges in the energetic system. Our own neurophysiology is telling us you're overloaded. You need to find a way to dissolve this, to decharge that. Those negative charges that we've picked up on the subtle without realizing it. If we don't, what happens is they build up over time. We get sick, or we develop emotional issues like anxiety, depression, addiction, or can't sleep. You know, everybody's neurophysiology is different. So we process these kinds of stressors differently, but be sure they're there whether you think they are or you don't think they are. It's part of the natural human nature that we absorb stress and pain. As I say, that's a beautiful thing. We should do that, but you got to wring the sponge up. So one of the things that I have are very, very simple techniques. They're like so stupid simple, you can't even fathom how stupid simple they are, but they work. To give that energy back to nature, where it kind of originated anyhow, and to offload those kinds of stressors in an energetic way back to dissolve in the cosmic so that we don't have to carry them. We use physicalized elements of nature. The whole Indian tradition, the deep miracle healing energy tradition, is linked with the five elements of nature, what they will call, like, the whole creation is made of these elements: the earth, the fire, the sky, the water, the air. And each of us and everything in the material world is a different configuration of these elements. For example, in the human system, our bones are earth element, right? They're very dense. They hold energy, right? Majority of our body, 75% is water, flesh, blood, circulatory system, salivary system, reproductive. It's all liquid, right? Fire. We have digestive fire. We also have a spark in the eyes. You can see when somebody's kind of twinkly versus when they're kind of dead in the eyes. Literally, the word inspiration comes from the Greek pyros, fire. You can tell when somebody's, there's a spark. There's a flame. So we're made of these elements. Therefore, when we're holding stress in our system, whether we're aware of it or not, the way to get rid of it is through physicalized representations of the elements that we're made of. The simplest way to do it. It's so stupid simple. And I'm telling you, people underrate it and don't recognize how intensely powerful this is every time you go in the shower or the bathtub, every time. And if you're really stressed, overwhelmed, something's hurting inside after a day of work, rather than taking a pill to relieve that, we normalize the symptoms of stress, not even realizing that that's what we're like. Our system is telling us, it's screaming, hey, you need to decharge this right now. But we're like, okay, mask the symptoms, you know, take a drink, eat something, take a pill. Oh, I feel so much better. No, you don't. I'm sorry. You don't. And the next day, then there's a little more. The next day, there's a little more. The next day, there's a little more, until your system will go into some kind of distress one way or another. The simplest way to do it is when you're feeling that, rather than trying to buy it off or medicate it in some way, go take a shower. And in the shower, in the water element, which again is, you know, reverberating with like 75% of our body is made out of a physically liquid something, right? Mm-hmm. You think two things. So simple. First one is a kind of a gratitude statement. Let's say it's a kind of prayer. but it doesn't matter. You believe in God, you don't believe in God, who cares? Maybe you love nature, or maybe you're really attached to Jesus or Buddha or Mother Nature or your higher power, or however you talk about that stuff. It doesn't, the words don't matter. But the idea is thank you to something. Thank you for creating this water element that I'm using right now. Thank you. Why the gratitude? Gratitude opens the heart. When the heart is open, energy can move through it. It's really simple. So energy will move. So the unlocking the thing is to say thank you to source or whatever you want to call it. It really, the words don't matter. Thank you for this water element. Second part, right now, not 5 minutes from now, not tomorrow, right now. I am decharging anything I picked up today that is not me, knowingly or unknowingly, doesn't matter, right now. So by saying thank you, we've opened ourselves up so that the element of the water, which is very purifying, right? It's cleansing. Everybody feels great after you take a shower bath anyhow. It's just a normal thing. So what we're doing is we're amplifying the process about, I don't know, 1,000-fold by aligning with a kind of supernatural quality in the water through this little two-step thingy. Thank you. Right now, I am decharging whatever I received today, whatever stressors, whatever happened. That's not me. And you're standing there under the water for 10, 15 minutes and you see what happens. It's the normal feeling of being cleaned by, you know, standing in a shower, which is very refreshing. It will be significantly amplified. People who are very sensitive will feel it immediately. They might even start flashing on the encounters they had that day. Like, oh my God, it's coming up and out while they're under the water because of invoking this kind of a little process. And you don't have to stand there under the water for 10, 15 minutes going, I'm decharging, I'm decharging, I'm decharging. No, once you tell your consciousness, we're doing this, we're aligning with this water and we're getting rid of whatever these subtle stressors are that would otherwise stay in the system. Your consciousness knows how to do that. It knows how to bond with that water and let the process happen naturally.
So you don't have to picture like all the bad things flowing away from you or anything.
Nope. Although they might surface. They might bubble up in your mind. You're like, oh my God. Oh yeah, that thing happened. Oh, that conversation. You know, they might kind of on their way out, say a little hello. For people, let's say a psychotherapist who had a lot of clients, you know, that day, not uncommon that the faces will flash or the circumstances that they heard that day when they're standing under that water doing this thing. How do you know it's done? When the symptoms come down. When you're restored to a kind of feeling of, oh, I feel really peaceful now. Oh my God. That's what you really are. All the other stuff is an overlay. So maybe, you know, the symptom is obsessive thinking, or it's a body pain or a headache somewhere, or it's, you know, wanting to engage in a compulsive behavior to try to balance this energy that we received. Like a simple example, again, is if somebody yells at you, right? If they really ream you out, when you step away from that situation, you're shaking. Why are you shaking? Because some energy came into your subtle system that should not be there. And it's reverberating through your entire system. If we don't pull it out, we're stuck with it. And it's unnecessary. And the story, this, what I love about the energy techniques is that it doesn't matter the story. The story, you just cut to the chase, you pull out the energetic charge and it's done. It's gone. So it's a really efficient way to handle stress, pain, trauma, pressure, you know, all these feelings that people might be having over the holidays. Just go stand in the shower, do the little thing. Thank you so much. However you language the divine or source or something. Thank you for this water element. Right now, I'm decharging, you know, and it may be a really intense day where you have to do this a bunch throughout the day. Fine, do it. 15 minutes, who cares? Or you sit in the bathtub, you know, with the water like up to the neck and you do the same thing. Just make sure nobody touches that water, you know, drain it because your stuff gets absorbed in the water and you don't want anybody else to touch it because they'll suck your stuff. I had a colleague who is he's a Western MD. He's an internist, also a student of Kalishwar. And this guy said, you know, every day I come back from my clinic, very open-hearted physician. Every day I would feel like I'd been hit by 3 trucks. I would sit in front of the television. I would smoke a lot of pot. I would just watch TV without even seeing it for a couple hours. Couldn't talk to his wife. Couldn't talk to his kids. Lost his marriage, of course. Could not be present. And he said, I assume this was the life of a physician because that's what medical school was like. That's what they geared us to expect. Seemed like that's what it was. he met Kaleshwar, he started decharging, and he said, a half an hour of these kinds of techniques, there are many that link to the elements. The water is probably the simplest, but he said, I would decharge on my way home from work, a half an hour. By the time I got home, I'm completely alert, I'm present. All of that overlay of exhaustion and deer in the headlights and numbness and all that he was feeling, it was everybody else's stuff that he had interacted with that day. All his patients, he was carrying all of their suffering, all their trauma without realizing it.
Yeah. It's hard to notice it because I'm sure it just kind of attaches to you and you think you're walking away from it, but you're,
yes, but you're not.
Got it cycling around in your head. And, you know, yeah, I used to know a psychiatrist here. I dated one briefly and he was kind of a mess, you know? I mean, he would stay home all weekend, like drinking wine and watching movies on the couch because he did not want to.
No.
I think people were like too much for him because Monday through Friday, he was constantly dealing with all these awful problems that people would tell him. And I think he just could not deal with socializing and stuff on the weekends.
For sure. When your sponge is so full and saturated with the pain and suffering of other people and you don't know how to wring it out effectively, how could you possibly? There's no more room. There's no more room. And you think about people who have been in practice for 20, 30 years and no decharging. And what I see is that a lot of the pain and suffering and the numbness and the confusion that people have, plus their symptoms, right? Psychological or emotional or physical or some combination of all of it, is simply coming out of this lack of handling the amount of energy that we absorb naturally from other people all the time. So it's a big education, I think. And at my energeticsofselfcare.com website, I got so concerned during the pandemic in the first wave when it hit the US, because I have friends on the front line. I have a lot of friends on the front line. And I thought, oh my God, everybody's going to be, you know, tanking if they don't have these techniques. And so I made that site initially kind of with the idea of getting this in the hands of, you know, nurses, physicians, respiratory therapists, EMS, and so on, all the people who are really being slammed and who are quitting in droves because they are just burned out. But so I made very simple training series in very short bites of these exact techniques, how to go through the elements. Some of them they can do while they're working. Because what I see for stress relief is that people who are already highly stressed, they don't have the time to add another action item onto their agenda to get rid of their stress. That's stress inducing. So I was like, all right, here's the thing. 20 minute bites, learn these techniques. You can do them while you are in the stressful situation. You can do them while you're working. Obviously the shower, you can't, but other techniques you can use right on the spot to dissolve it. So let's say, you know, a nurse has three patients who code blue, which is not uncommon right now. And they're just overwhelmed and they have the grief of the families and all like that. They can totally decharge that within a few minutes and go on to the next one and be fresh and clean and go on to the next one and go on to the next one. Or somebody in retail who's getting, you know, a lot of angry consumers, kind of giving them the face because everybody's got pandemic fatigue up to here and they didn't get their thing, the present they're trying to buy, and it's not the right color. And right. I mean, a lot of people are on the receiving end of the collective frustration right now. And without decharging that every day, you can't keep your head above the water and still be reasonable, peaceful, happy, you know, all the stuff that we hopefully would be at this season. So I made that site initially with frontline workers in mind, but these techniques apply to, I would say, every single human being. I've had friends who their little kindergartner would come up to them and say, Mom, here's your black rock, which is another thing that goes along with the decharging techniques. Mom, you really need this right now. You're a little stressed right now. Like, I think if kids were taught these techniques, the amount of misunderstanding and confusion and bullying and contentiousness, even on the playground or in the classroom, would come down by like 90%, because majority of where we're acting from is not our own stuff.
Yeah, you're right. It's processing all the other stuff that's happened to us. Yeah. And it's just like an accretion of bad things that you can't shake off unless you learn how.
Yeah. So an extreme example of that is PTSD, right? If we look at, you know, combat vets, I've worked a lot with combat veterans. I love combat veterans. You know, we're talking about young men, right? Usually 18 to 20, who have done and seen things that no human being should do or see, that are that horrific. And I will argue that the way PTSD happens to us is the soul, which is a very tender place in us, linked to the heart, receives like a burst of a horrific experience. Now it's lodged in the energetic system. And until it's decharged effectively, So then you see the flashbacks, you get the nightmares, you have the behaviors and so on. And they can last for decades. We worked with a combat veteran in the Bay Area who was in his 70s. He was a Vietnam vet. He had become a psychiatrist to help other veterans after his experiences in Vietnam. He was in a unit called the Unit of the Walking Dead, I believe it was called. Ho Chi Minh targeted this platoon of Marines and to make an example of them and pounded them mercilessly. Out of, I think there were 1,200 people in the original unit, 200 walked out alive by the end of it. This guy was one of them. He said, oh yeah, we'd get shelled and I would go unconscious and wake up on a pile of bodies of my former colleagues. And this was a routine experience for him. So he had a lot to process from Vietnam. He became a psychiatrist. He worked with combat vets for 40 years before he retired. The guy in his 70s, sweetest man on the planet, was sleeping with a loaded gun under his pillow, was using evasive maneuvers to go home from his office. Never took the same way twice, right? Waking up with the horrific nightmares, having the flashbacks and so on. We taught him how to decharge and we taught him a kind of meditation that he could use anytime the stuff was happening, which I think works hand in hand very beautifully with the decharging techniques. And he wrote us a clinical, as a psychiatrist, endorsement. After 6 months, he said, oh my God, I have seen a significant decrease in flashbacks, in nightmares, in evasive maneuvers and compulsive activity that I have done out of my PTSD. Like unbelievable relief, because all those things that were lodged in there were finally able to dissolve, to get decharged, to get pulled out of his system once and for all. As an energetic pulling out, not as a psychological, okay, well, let's process it again and again and again. The energetic charge is still there, no matter how much you talk about it, don't talk about it. Try to do things around it, try to cover it, ameliorate it in some way. There are a lot of beautiful things out there for PTSD, but none of them, in my experience, get right to the heart of it and actually pull out that initial, like it was injected in the heart in a painful way. Or repeatedly, you know, in the case of someone who was on a couple tours of duty in Vietnam and saw a lot, not just one event. That all has to come out, my experience, energetically. And these tools do that. So like with people who are experiencing repeated trauma in their lives, that will lead to burnout. It will lead to PTSD if it doesn't get addressed effectively now. These are the tools. So that might be with the family interactions. It might be with the loss. It might be with the anxiety over work. It might be, you know, having no money. It might be, oh my God, how are we going to get through Christmas? Because I have kids and we can't afford food, let alone presents.
Yeah.
You know, like all these kinds of stressors. Using these kinds of decharging techniques, at least it clears that kind of stuff out of the system so that you can think clearly.
And I would add to it that sometimes people put too much pressure on themselves to have like fanciness and stuff that, I mean, years ago, I just stopped worrying about Christmas. I just made myself stop worrying about it. Yeah. And I thought, I don't really care what I do as long as I'm just happy. I don't want to worry about the gift exchange thing too much. I do buy gifts sometimes, but I don't buy like lavish gifts. I don't entertain a lot at this time of year because I feel the pressure would be a lot. I'm not exactly like a world-class cook, so I'm not going to invite people over and cook for them, for example. And you can control some things. And I feel like people need to think about this. Okay, what can I control? Like, how much should I really bend over backwards to do things for family or whatever? If it's going to break your back to bend over, don't do it.
No, not worth it, you know. And I feel like simplicity is usually the most moving. Even, I know this is going to sound really corny, but like, rather than buying somebody something, make them something. Maybe you are a good cook. Maybe you make cookies for somebody. Maybe you draw a beautiful card for someone. Maybe your gift is like going for a walk on the beach with your dear friend together at a certain time, you know, like making gifts that are not retail sales with bows and ribbons, but really heartful, writing a poem, you know, for someone. Like, you know, I lived a good part of my young life with not even two pennies to rub together to do anything. Christmas was always a feeling of, but I want to give. So I would find what were my gifts internally and find a way to express them. And they were always so moving to people, you know.
It's always the experience you're going for, like a good experience rather than a thing that you want to,
correct.
I would say, shift away from buying the thing that's amazing. Just have the experience.
Yep.
You know, have a candlelit living room and do beautiful things that are doable and not like, don't try to overshoot Martha Stewart. I mean, there's just so many little things you can do. I mean, sometimes I have a fireplace here where I live right now and, you know, just having like a little candlelight and the fire going, sometimes that makes me feel so happy. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why. I mean, I don't know. Maybe I like fire.
It's the nature of the fire. It automatically decharges a lot of our stress and pain.
It gives me like kind of a peaceful, cozy feeling. And I think, okay, I can't do this all year round. I can definitely do it this time of year though. So I'll take advantage of that. And I think that just thinking small and incorporating meaning into whatever your experience is through the holidays, that's the target, not buying this or buying that.
No, I think it's heartful. You know, maybe you're out for a walk, like if somebody's living in a wintry area and you see a beautiful scene in nature, take a picture of it and make that your Christmas present to people. Come from the heart in a simple way to share an experience that don't require laying down money. And also I did see, there was a beautiful thing. Somebody did a write-up on social media saying, you know, instead of buying things for people that you think they'll like, this year, especially when a lot of people are really pressed, you know, financially, ask the people around you what they really need. Maybe they need a little extra cash to get through the month. Maybe they need somebody to do childcare for them one day a week. Maybe they need someone to take them to a medical appointment. You know, like maybe that can be the Christmas gift, that it's something that people really would value and are perhaps afraid to ask for themselves. And so I think the invitation is we can engage with our loved ones in a meaningful way, or not trying to project what we think they want, but really asking them, like, what do you want? What do you really need? Mm-hmm. What would really be of benefit? What would really help you, you know, at this time of the year, right now? That hit me like really hard. I thought, yeah, exactly. Isn't that a kind of call to action? That might be a departure for many people.
Yes, very good idea. I like that very much.
I think whenever we help others, we're really in the spirit of the Christmas time.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a time of year for sharing. So keep that in mind.
Yeah.
Alex, it was great to have you on my podcast. I would love to have you back again because I think that we kind of like chicken scratch the surface here of what you can do. So we'll probably bring you around again.
That'd be great.
2022 and talk about some of the other stuff you do, maybe.
Yes, that would be a great, great pleasure. Absolutely.
Feel free to leave questions or comments for this episode at disembodiedpodcast.com.